I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of December. And it's all things political with Molly Ball this hour. She covers national politics for The Atlantic. With her loss in a runoff to Bill Cassidy in Louisiana, Democrats will not control a single governorship, Senate seat, or legislative chamber from the Carolinas to Texas. Mary Landrieu lost on Saturday of last week. We asked the question, what has happened to the Democratic Party in the South? Mitch McConnell, the new Senate Majority Leader, has been blamed for stopping most of the Obama agenda. Will continued obstructionism serve the Republican interests? What's next for the Democrats? Ted Strickland, former governor of Ohio, told Molly that the Democrats have spent too much time developing small-bore message for niche audiences without painting a larger picture of their vision. And she wrote a very interesting piece about Martin O'Malley might be the most ignored candidate of 2016. Also, today, of course, lawmakers are finalizing the $1.1 trillion spending bill that would fund the government, and that needs to be passed by Wednesday. Well, they hope on Wednesday because the government would not have any more money come Thursday of this week. So we'll be talking about that and much more this hour of the program with Molly Ball. Molly has joined us before. She's a staff writer, as I said, covering national politics for The Atlantic. She joined the magazine in September of 2011 from Politico, where she covered the fight for the 2012 GOP nomination, the 2010 midterm elections, and the national political landscape. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her during the course of the hour at 800-486-8654. The email is talk@wpr.org. We always love to read your messages on Facebook. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, where if you like us, we'll send you upcoming notes about what's coming up. And we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Hi, Molly. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start with what in the world happened to the Democratic Party in the South. I think that's a remarkable thing here. The Democrats won't control a single governorship, Senate seat, or legislative chamber from the Carolinas to Texas. Goodness.
Yeah, it has really been a wipeout, and it has really been what happened to the Democratic Party in the South, I can tell you in two words, it's Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
We have this impression that the South, you know, started turning Republican when the parties began to realign in the 60s with the civil rights movement and Nixon's Southern strategy. But it's really been much more recent. You know, it was really possible for Democrats to continue to run sort of in opposition to the National Party in the ensuing decades until Obama came along, and any Democratic or Republican strategist in a deep Southern state will tell you it has been a methodical effort where all Republicans really have to do is put a candidate on a flyer next to Obama, and voters in the South seem to react very strongly to that, and they have been pretty much systematically eliminating Democratic candidates from statewide office in pretty much all these states. Now, there are exceptions, of course. We've seen some states seeming to start trending the other way. I live in Virginia, the capital of the old Confederacy, which is now a sort of, you know, bluish-purple state where both senators are Democrats and the governor is a Democrat. North Carolina went for Obama in 2008, but not in 2012, and now all the statewide offices in North Carolina are back to being Republican. So some of these states are teetering on the brink, and I think the bigger question raised by the 2014 election is which way is this trend line going?
Mm-hmm.
Democrats thought for a long time that the demographic trend in this country was going in one direction in their favor. The 2014 election raises the question, is there a countervailing trend in the other direction that's going to be much harder for them to sort of, enact this manifest destiny that I think a lot of Democrats envisioned in the Obama years.
Yeah. Well, and as you write in your piece in The Atlantic, Cassidy wasn't a particularly attractive candidate, and you write that his campaign consisted almost entirely of putting Landrieu and Obama in the same sentence at the bottom of the screen. Don't you need to have – it's hard to understand because her name is so well known in Louisiana, and she's not really a liberal Democrat. She tried to get the Keystone Pipeline passed. What is it? What is that saying? You can win against somebody who's not even a very strong candidate?
Yeah, it was really all about the R next to his name. And this is something we saw over and over again on November 4th as well. I think a lot of Democrats sort of fooled themselves, thought that if you had a famous political name, you know, Mary Landrieu came from a long political family in Louisiana. Mark Pryor came from a storied political dynasty in Arkansas. Michelle Nunn in Georgia. They thought their individual characteristics would be enough to make people forget that they belong to the same party as Obama. And a lot of reporters, myself included, looked at all of these Republican campaigns across the country before November saying, oh, this is so boring. This is so one note. They can't talk about anything except Obama. Do they really expect that voters, that that'll be enough for voters? And the answer was yes. That was what voters wanted. They wanted to cast that vote that was a rejection of Barack Obama, of his policies, of Obamacare, and of the national Democratic agenda. And that was absolutely enough, even if you were a Bill Cassidy who was almost explicitly not offering anything else. His entire campaign message was vote against Obama.
Yeah. So tell me about this black-white split. Fewer, evidently, than one out of five white voters almost voted for Landrieu. Three out of four told pollsters they strongly disapproved of the president. But for the one-third black population, overwhelmingly Democratic, and voted that way, voted Democratic in this particular race. What is this racial divide here?
It's really true in a lot of these deep South states. Mississippi is another one where I've had the occasion to do some reporting this year, that the parties are, you know, the Democratic Party is the black party and the Republican Party is the white party these days. And this is something that troubles, you know, people from both parties who would not like to see our politics break down along such racial lines. And you have to wonder if that is an effect that is going to outlast Obama to the degree that it is something of a racial effect. I think Democrats thought that candidates who were not Obama would be able to take, you know, there's a good side of this for Democrats, which is that in the Obama era, they have seen minority turnout consolidate in their favor and increase. That meaning more minorities have turned out to vote when Obama was on the ballot, and more of them have voted for Democrats. So that's something that helps Democrats. At the same time, in the South, not necessarily in the rest of the country, they have seen their share of the white vote precipitately decline. And so I think candidates like a Mary Landrieu or Mark Pryor thought, well, okay, I'll get all those minority votes who are excited about in favor of Obama, but I'll also be able to preserve the traditional share that Democrats have gotten of the white vote. Mary Landrieu in her last election got over 30% of the white vote. Instead, what happened was that those white voters have really fled the Democratic Party, and the minority voters don't show up when Obama's not on the ballot. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a double whammy for those Democratic candidates.
So should Hillary be nominated in 2016, the Democrats may have some problems?
They may. I think it raises a big question for her. I don't have an opinion about which way it goes. But it means that, you know, Democrats cannot bank on any of the sort of demographic factors that they have banked on for the last 8 years.
And what are the reasons for the strong dislike of President Obama?
Well, you know, you talk to people, Republicans in the South, and they will tell you that it is not racial. You talk to Democrats in the South, and they will tell you that it absolutely is racial. You know, Obama has driven white voters away from the Democratic Party in the South in a way that, you know, even liberal Democratic nominees in the past, such as John Kerry or Michael Dukakis, did not. And so that's something that people raise as evidence that, you know, if this isn't racial, what is it? And you know, the South is still a place that has deep racial divisions and racial scars. On the other hand, those other candidates also didn't pass Obamacare, and Obamacare is a policy that polls particularly badly in the South, particularly among white voters in the South. And, you know, I spoke with a former governor of Louisiana, Mike Foster, who said that he does not believe that this is primarily racial, a former Republican governor, but that he believes that Southern voters look at Obama and his administration as a sort of quasi-socialist enterprise devoted to giving things away to people who can't be bothered to work. And for the hardworking people of the South, that's something that disturbs them.
And what is the president giving away to people who don't work?
Well, things like Obamacare, which is an entitlement, right, which is something that gives subsidies to people who can't afford health insurance, for example.
They might be working.
They might be working, but they are also getting something from the government, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to wonder, because you also cite as recently as 2007, which was right before he was elected, Democrats controlled both houses of the Louisiana legislature and 7 of 9 statewide offices, including the governor. Today, Republicans have large majorities in both houses, and we've seen what happened in the Senate. I mean, it's a remarkable change.
It's been a bloodbath, and it's exactly the same thing in Arkansas. It's the same thing in a lot of these states, southern states that really have just realigned. In a lot of them, you've had Democrats switch and become Republicans in order to stay in office. So, states like North Carolina, states like Arkansas, states like Louisiana really did not turn Republican at the state level until Obama was elected.
So let's move to... You have to help me understand this. Martin O'Malley, you wrote a very interesting piece about him in The Atlantic, saying that he ought to be a Democrat's dream candidate, 2 terms as governor of Maryland, and talk about liberal, ushering in, you write, a sweeping liberal agenda, gay marriage, gun control, an end to the death penalty, and in-state college tuition for undocumented immigrants. Why does he have such support?
Well, he doesn't, is the point. My article was sort of pointing out a conundrum where O'Malley is concerned. He's strongly considering a run for president. Most people believe that's what he's gearing up for. And yet, he's been all over the country bringing his message to Democratic constituencies for the better part of a year. No Democrat, including Hillary Clinton, has done more to campaign for Democratic candidates in the midterm elections. And yet, in these early polls of Democratic primary voters, he gets 1 or 2%. He's way behind not just Hillary, but like a Joe Biden, even a Bernie Sanders, who's not even a Democrat, tends to get more of the vote than Martin O'Malley. Elizabeth Warren, who, of course, says she's not running, but she has much more support in these early polls. And so the question is, given that laundry list of liberal accomplishments that you just read, why isn't he resonating with people? What's the problem? And so I set out to meet him and get to know him and understand why that is, try to answer that question.
What about in Maryland? Does he resonate there?
Well, it seemed like it, but this last election was a little bit of a rejection of him in Maryland. This happened after this article went to press, but one of the biggest surprises of the midterm elections was that the Democratic candidate for governor, who had been O'Malley's lieutenant governor and was largely seen as O'Malley's handpicked candidate, lost the gubernatorial election to a sort of no-name Republican opponent that nobody expected to win, that everybody expected would just not have a chance in this very overwhelmingly blue state. O'Malley's had mostly positive approval ratings, but people look at that election and say, well, this is not, a ringing endorsement of the changes that he's brought to Maryland. There's obviously some kind of a backlash that has to be, not just by virtue of the national Democratic wave, but maybe something to do with O'Malley's leadership as well. So I tend to think that doesn't hurt his 2016 chances so much, just because his 2016 chances were pretty negligible to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But to the extent that people were considering him, I think that is a little bit of a blow to his credentials.
And yet, in another article that you wrote, What's Next for the Democrats, you talk about with a lot of people who say that Democrats need to stick to their values. When we don't do that, we lose. It would seem to me as though O'Malley is exemplifying what Democratic values have been, and yet he's not registering as a presidential candidate. How does that play in? Was that a part of the equation here or not? That they weren't espousing what their values are.
Well, again, a part that my O'Malley profile was written before the midterm elections, so I don't really know whether the midterms will cause Democrats to give O'Malley a second look. I tend to doubt it. My feeling from the Democrats I've been talking to has been that there's a little bit of trepidation about Hillary, but not too much defection from the idea that she still represents the party's strongest potential candidate. That being said, I've spent the last couple of years covering the Republican Civil War, because that has been one of the biggest forces in American politics in the last few years. And I don't know if what we have is a democratic civil war quite yet. But we do have a lot of uncertainty. Anytime a party undergoes a defeat, there's a lot of uncertainty about what it means, what kind of message voters were trying to send, and exactly what the Republicans went through, which was this period of introspection where some faction of the party said, well, they didn't reject our philosophies, right? We don't need to be more moderate. We just need to be clearer about what we stand for. So that might be something that, like, a Ted Cruz was saying after 2012, right? Saying we just need to be more conservative and get more people to hear what we're really saying instead of being all mushy so they don't actually understand what we stand for. So you do hear a lot of Democrats now saying that the answer is for them to sort of double down on a liberal message and to be more forceful about, progressive economic policies, even social liberalism in certain parts of the country, and that the reason that voters didn't vote for Democrats is because they stayed home, because they weren't excited about this lack of vision that the Democratic candidates put forward.
And it's hard to ignore the fact, Molly, that a lot of people did stay home.
A lot of people did stay home, and but we don't know why they stayed home, right? Because they stayed home, they weren't in the exit polls, and we couldn't ask them, did you stay home because you didn't care if the Democrat or the Republican got elected? Did you stay home because you otherwise would have voted for a Democrat? Did you stay home because you otherwise would have voted for a Republican and you just didn't feel the need, you know? So I think it's a little bit dangerous to practice that sort of mind reading or projection on the voters who didn't vote. But of course, if you are a Democrat, you need more of those voters if you're going to win a presidential election.
Well, why doesn't somebody do a study of why people stayed home? I'd like to know the answer.
I would, too. I there are sometimes polls of non-voters. I know there was a poll in 2012, for example, of people who don't vote in general. And it found that, kind of in keeping with what you might expect, given the factors that tend to correlate with turnout, they tended to be lower income and minority people more so than the voting population. And they tended to be more sympathetic to Democrats than the voting population. But it's obviously a population that changes in different elections.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Molly Ball is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, and we're looking. What do you make of this? I'm sure you'll have some insightful comments about what happened in the South. Democrats not controlling one single governorship, Senate seat, or legislative chamber, all the way from the Carolinas to Texas. The South, the Deep South, is red. It is completely red. What happened to the Democratic Party in the South? Is the answer for Democrats, as we've been talking about with Molly, to stand for something, to stand for liberal democratic policies? Will that help them do better or not? We have yet to move into new Congress, which we will be viewing and observing come January. Mitch McConnell, Molly wrote an interesting piece on him, the new Senate Majority Leader. How will he lead? Will there be continued obstructionism or not? And we'll be talking about the budget. The government has to be funded by this Thursday, or if not, you know, we could have another government shutdown. It doesn't appear as though that's likely to happen, but we'll ask Molly about that. There is some belief that the Department of Homeland Security will not be funded at the level it needs to be as a response to President Obama's executive action on immigration. Well, here's our phone number. Give us a call, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter @KDunnShow, and we'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later tonight at 6, Hidden Kitchens, Texas. We'll travel across the Lone Star State with stories of cowboy kitchens, chili queens, the birth of the Frito. It's radio that tastes real good. Hidden Kitchens, Texas, tonight at 6 on the Ideas Network. Let's go to phone calls now for Molly Ball, our guest for All Things Political, covers national politics for The Atlantic, and Ron in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I have two questions, and I'll take my answer off the air. My first question is, how did gerrymandering that was going on affect the election? And my second question is, what do you think would happen if Elizabeth Warren would run for president? And with that, I'll just take
You'll
my
say
answer
goodbye.
Off the air.
Thanks, Ron.
Two very good questions. To the first one, I would say that we're talking primarily about statewide elections here. We're talking about U.S. Senate seats, governorships, and even the legislative chamber. Obviously, those individual lines are drawn for seats, but on the whole, we're talking about the statewide balance of power. So gerrymandering doesn't affect that very much. And interestingly, it's Democrats who you hear complaining the most about the effect of the Voting Rights Act on the way districts are drawn in the South, because the Voting Rights Act is intended to maximize minority representation. That's not the same thing as maximizing Democratic representation. So what often ends up happening in these deep Southern states is that Black Democratic voters are concentrated in majority-minority districts rather than having their votes spread out in a way that might elect more Democrats across the state. As for the second question, you know, Elizabeth Warren has been included in a lot of polls of potential Democratic primary voters, and she doesn't stack up even close to Hillary Clinton. There is obviously a very vocal liberal wing of the Democratic Party that would very much like to see her run, but it's not clear whether they actually believe that she could be the nominee, or that they just want to see her argue with Hillary and give Hillary a run for her money and make Hillary maybe even move to the left on some of these economic issues, which I think Hillary has been doing anyway without Warren being in the race. And I think that's what will keep Warren out of the race, is if Hillary seems to be addressing her issues, talking about economic inequality, not running so centrist a campaign that someone like Warren feels that she has a responsibility to get in and speak for her side of the argument.
Glenn in Blue Mounds. Hi, Glenn.
Hi there. I have three items that I might bring up as calling the Democrats problems before this last election and continuing. The concept of Obamacare, he should have said right from the beginning, rather than being co-opted by the Republicans and calling it that himself, he should have said, listen, MyoCare is so good, it's probably the best in the world. It's not even in question. It's your care I'm worried about. So let's be more conservative, save a syllable, and call it people care. We're both ways on double entendre. Secondly, most media keeps calling him our first Black president, when he and I both had white mothers. Now, I voted for him twice, so don't get me wrong here. But the fact is he's gray, he's not Black. That sounds weird to say that, biracial. Euro-Afro-American, giving a greater nod to the people that actually raised him. And third, just before this last election, everybody was lamenting on how his approval rating was down in the low 40s, when he should have said, listen, that's only 400% better than Congress. I guess that's about all I have
all right.
to offer right now.
Thank you for offering, Glenn. Molly.
Well, none of those are questions, so I'm not sure I have anything to add. Interesting points. There has been some rumbling among Democrats that maybe a lot of what did them in this election was a general anger at incumbents and at the system and at Washington, that it wasn't only at one side or the other, but just saying, you know, and this is in sync with the caller's point about the president as well, that when people are mad at Washington, they blame the president. They blame whoever they perceive as being in charge. And in a time of divided government, that's going to be whoever's at the top, whoever is in the White House. And that is also part of the reason that in the sixth year of any incumbent's two terms, there tends to be this kind of backlash effect. There tends to be a loss of seats for the president's party. There's just a fatigue that sets in and a desire on the part of voters to get some kind of fresh point of view in there. So I think those are all potentially valid arguments.
Let's talk, before we go back to phone calls, let's talk a little bit about the $1.1 trillion spending bill. which there was some hope that it would be unveiled today. I think there's a party at the White House tonight, so I'm not sure that that will be done. But there is a little bit of concern, or a lot of concern, that this could not be accomplished by Thursday when it needs to be accomplished, or we'd be seeing another shutdown.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big test for the Republicans. Granted, the Republicans who are in Washington now are not the newly elected Republicans, because they don't take office until next month. But still, the Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, this is very much a test for them of whether they can corral their troops and get them on board for a sort of new normal in Washington that they have promised. They have promised to run Washington in a way that doesn't, you know, careen wildly from crisis to crisis in the way we've seen for the last several years, but instead brings back some semblance of order and stability and certainty for the people who depend on government being open. I think at this point it's very much an open question. The bill is hoping to be unveiled tonight by Republican leaders in the House. It's being called the Cromnibus, which is some kind of Frankensteinian, you know, combination of a continuing resolution and an omnibus bill. Those are just two different jargon names for government funding bills. But the idea is that it would fund all of government for the better part of the year, except for the Department of Homeland Security, because Homeland Security includes immigration. And so it would put that on a much shorter leash, only until next month through January. And then the new Republican Congress would have a chance to do something else with Homeland Security funding. The problem for Republicans is they are very mad at Obama over his executive action on immigration, but
yes,
there's not very much they can do about it. The the functions that are affected by the executive order are self-funding, so there isn't even a funding mechanism that Congress controls that could stop the suspension of deportations from being implemented. And so the word that you hear a lot from Republican leaders is that they want something sort of cathartic. They want something that allows the conservative members who are so mad at the president a way to vent in a sort of symbolic stand without actually messing anything up, without shutting down the government,
mm-hmm.
without getting in the way of proceeding in an orderly fashion to do the things that everyone in Congress knows they have to do. So they say over and over again they don't want to shut down the government. How they are going to avoid that still remains to be seen.
And what about this funding at a lower level, Homeland Security? Is this part of a strategy to do that come February?
Yeah, January or February. The idea would be that the rest of the government gets funded through, I believe, next September, and the Department of Homeland Security only gets funded through January. So that then the new Congress, pretty much immediately when they take office on January 3rd, has to set about finding some way that satisfies them to fund Homeland Security. They'd like to stop the president from doing what he's done on immigration, but most experts say that it is legal, and that there isn't even a funding mechanism that they could employ to stop it. So they're
mm-hmm.
sort of casting about for ways to express their annoyance with the president for what he's done on immigration.
We go to John in Janesville next. Hi, John.
How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Not too bad. It just seems like nobody's making any money, and they're complaining that they're not bringing money into the government. Your taxes and stuff, we're so short on money in the government, and all the states and stuff are saying that too. But nobody's working for anything. Everybody's working for minimum wage or way below what they were years ago. I took $1,000 a month pay cut.
Mm.
So, you know, that makes you spend a lot less, and you're not paying as much taxes. So if more people were working and more people are working at better jobs, more taxes would be brought in, and they wouldn't have to worry about as much money then.
Molly.
Well, sure, that would be great. I have no idea how you do it, right? I mean, it is true that wages have largely flatlined for the last several years, and that even though the economy on paper is doing very well on a macro level, from the stock market to the unemployment rate to even the rate of jobs being created, last month was a particularly strong number, there is a feeling that people are not feeling it, that the majority of the gains since the economic crash, since the recovery from that economic crash, the majority of those gains have gone to the very top tier, whether it's the top 1% or top 5%. And the rest of us are languishing away, not getting pay raises, not getting a better deal. And that's something that, you know, politicians have to address. It's this very, and it's a reason that, that I think Democrats in particular have not been able to take more credit for the economy doing better, because they are acutely aware that most people don't feel like things are getting that much better. So, you know, the question is, what do you promise to address that? You know, you have the liberals who say, well, we've got to tax the rich and give more of that money to everyone else, or raise the minimum wage, which was a political winner in a lot of states on November 4th, even in red states like Arkansas that were voting for Republican candidates, were voting to raise the minimum wage at the same time. It's an issue that polls very well. So you do have a lot of Democrats saying we need to be louder about a sort of economically progressive message. And, you know, we heard even a lot of Republican candidates campaigning on this idea that whatever economic gains we're making as a country are not reaching the majority of the public. What is their plan to deal with it beyond sort of getting government out of the way? What kind of proposals are they going to espouse? I think that's going to be a major battleground in the next presidential election in 2016.
So if this is this large an issue, and I agree, I think that it is in this country, why is it that someone like Elizabeth Warren or James Webb, for that matter, who's expressed interest in being president, pull way, way down, whereas Hillary Clinton, who's not taken on that kind of message, pulls very well?
Well, this actually is something that Hillary is talking a lot about. And one of the interesting things of the last few months is that since Hillary's been out on the campaign trail, campaigning, of course, not for herself, but for other Democrats in the midterms, she has started to sketch out a message. This was a sort of big criticism of her in her sort of pre-candidacy phase, was that she didn't seem to have anything to say. But as she got out there on the campaign trail, she did start putting together this message of economic empowerment, talking about particularly family-friendly policies, economically empowering women, but also in general talking about getting a better deal for people who work for a living. And so I think that that is going to be a major centerpiece of a potential Hillary Clinton campaign. And I think part of the reason that Hillary is polling so well among Democrats is not just that they've known her for a long time and she's a famous name and she's a celebrity, but because they do feel that she speaks to that part of the message in much the same way that her husband did when he was president.
We welcome phone calls, 800-486-8655. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network, and Molly Ball is our guest. She is the national political staff writer for The Atlantic, and she covers national politics. And we go to Jim next in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Today, my main topic is torture, but a quick aside with the Clintons, watch what they say. Not what they say, but what they do. Way back in several years ago, Alfred McCoy, a history professor from UW, wrote a book called A Question of Torture. And on page 200, they talk about how even in 2003 that the Iraqis were plotting revenge and seizing, killing Americans for what was done at Abu Ghraib. Currently, the administration is trying to say that you shouldn't release the report because Americans might be killed. But that thought has been in the Iraqis' mind a lot earlier than this. And I think we should contact Tammy Baldwin, ask her to get the report out. And as far as CIA redactions, it's fine to protect the names of people, but we certainly should not protect the American people from the details of what happened, because it should never happen again.
Molly.
Again, more of a comment, but and this is not an area of my particular expertise, but this is something with the CIA torture report that Congress is trying, some members of Congress are trying to have released potentially this week, and they've been going back and forth with the administration and with the agency on what kinds of redactions need to be made in order to release it. That's still up in the air, but I've talked to members of Congress who are optimistic that that is going to happen, and then I think we will have a whole new political fight over what that means, like the caller said.
Let's go to some Facebook messages and emails. Comment on them as you will, Molly. Steve sends this. It's my opinion that Obama let a lot of people down and fed the Republican narrative by bungling the rollout of his signature piece of legislation. People gave up on him at that point. Teresa on Facebook says she stayed home on 11/4/2014 because no one, Democratic or Republican, deserved or earned her trust, much less her vote. And Tamara on Facebook says, we're not making mention of the elephant in the room, racism, which she said is rampant in this country and has gone ballistic since President Obama was elected. It is a sad commentary on our nation.
I did talk a little bit about the race factor before, and it's not something that I feel qualified to say too much more about than that. As for the other commenters, those are very interesting. I mean, I do think that the Affordable Care Act still looms very large over this midterm election, and I don't think we know exactly what effect it had. Obviously, we can't live in a universe where it never happened. But, you know, as the commenter mentioned, how much of this is about the policy itself and the fact that a lot of people had their insurance canceled, the fact that a lot of people experienced disruptive changes to their health care, even as others were getting a benefit from the law and seeing their situation improve. And then how much was about that disastrous rollout and the impression that it created in a lot of people's minds, along with the way the administration was handling other crises, whether foreign policy crises, the border crisis, the Ebola crisis. There were a lot of things in the last year or so that led people to question this administration's competence. And that was a message that I heard from a lot of Republican candidates across the country, that it wasn't even so much about the president's policies as about his inability to execute and to just make government function. And so, of course, now the ball is in their court, and Republicans are acutely aware that they're going to have to prove that they can make government function at a time when a lot of people are deeply cynical about that possibility and deeply hostile to Washington that has, you know, bungled just about everything for as long as I can remember. So we'll see if they can do any better.
Yeah. Randy in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi. I'd like to go back to a comment that you made, Kathleen, or an observation regarding the one-third of the southeastern United States going red and just the general win for the Republicans overall.
We're saying all of the South went red, not just right. One-third.
Well, southern third of the country, I believe you said.
Okay.
In any event, how much can we ascribe to conservative fear of what they perceive as the Obama administration's liberal agenda, such as gains in within the Supreme Court on gay marriage and even Obamacare and maybe executive actions regarding immigration and all of that? I can take my answer off air.
Thanks, Randy.
Sure. I think it was very much, if you talk to Republican voters everywhere, their votes in the midterms were very much a reaction to the administration's quote-unquote liberal policies, whether it was on social policy, on things like gay marriage, although that's increasingly seen as a settled issue. And it's interesting how little you hear Republicans talk about gay marriage. I'm old enough to remember 2004 when being against gay marriage and passing state-level constitutional amendments to ban gay marriage was a big Republican initiative, and this was something that helped them make electoral gains and may have helped President Bush get reelected. Fast forward 10 years, and no Republican wants to touch this because, at this point, a narrow majority of Americans in almost every state is in favor of gay marriage, and even in very deep red states, I think in Texas it's something like 48% of people favor gay marriage. So this is an issue that Republicans have not been eager to campaign on opposition to like they used to, and it seems to be something that may be sort of fading from the national agenda, especially as it increasingly looks settled. The Supreme Court has yet to take it up, but in almost every other state, courts have interpreted previous Supreme Court rulings in a way that has made gay marriage legal, even in states like South Carolina and Utah. So that may be an issue that we don't hear about very much anymore. But in terms of, you know, were voters rejecting the Obama administration's liberal policies, I think they would say that they were. I think that the message that I heard from Republican candidates and from voters on the ground in states from the Deep South to places that went for Obama, like Colorado and Iowa, you still heard a lot of voters saying that they wanted to deliver a rebuke, deliver a check on the direction that Obama is taking this country. And that was a big reason for this Republican wave that we saw.
Molly Ball, our guest. It's All Things Political you're listening to for this Monday, the 8th of December. Molly covers national politics for The Atlantic, and look up her writing. She's written some very interesting pieces, most recently about Mary Landrieu's loss and what's happened to the Deep South now in this country, how Democrats have pretty much lost it all. She's written an interesting piece about Martin O'Malley, what's next for the Democrats, what's next for Mitch McConnell. And we're talking about all of that this hour. And we're also looking at what Congress is doing this week. We talked about the rollout of the $1.1 trillion spending bill expected today. Government would be shut down as of Thursday if this doesn't get through. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We have a couple lines open for you right now. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, our phone number for All Things Political, 800-486-8655. John in Milwaukee is next. Hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you. Three items maybe she could comment on, or one of the three. Just announced, I guess, the other day that China has just surpassed the United States as the world's the biggest producer of items, of goods. And our deficit, our debt, national debt, went over $18 trillion finally. And we, on the way to the New World Order, we're spending $1.2 trillion a year on military, and which actually makes that total of our debt, $18 trillion, what we spent on so-called defense against terror in the One World Order, establishment of the One World Order through conquest. Could you comment on any one of those subjects?
Thank you, John.
Don't think I am qualified to comment on any of those subjects. It sounds like a little bit of a conspiracy theory about the One World Order. I'm not aware of any such plans. I would say that, you know, particularly in a lot of Midwestern states, places like Wisconsin, in previous campaigns, I have heard a lot about China. I'm sure that, you know, there in Wisconsin, there is a lot of political hay to be made around issues regarding trade. And that wasn't something that I heard as much of in this particular midterm year. It was much more about the president and the administration and less about, you know, protecting against Chinese goods. But this is still, you know, one of the major issues that the new Republican Congress has said that they may take up is free trade. And that's something that really divides the Democratic Party. The administration is in favor of a lot of free trade agreements that the outgoing Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has declined to bring to the floor because he and a lot of his manufacturing state Democrats are opposed to them. So we'll see if Republicans will be able to get that done in the new Congress, because there's a pretty narrow swath of issues that some Democrats and some Republicans agree on, and that the new Congress might actually be able to make progress on, and trade is one of them.
Thanks, John, for the call. Al in northern Wisconsin. Hi.
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 Thanks for the show. I'm a longtime listener, and I don't get near as upset as I used to. But I wanted to bring up Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And they don't pull figures out of their hat, But ExxonMobil, 2012, they made $19 billion profit. They paid zero taxes, and they got $156 million back from our taxes. I also wanted to mention the Koch brothers, who have been on PBS with the wonderful show called An Independent Lens, Power, Money, and the American Dream. It kind of explains everything. And then they squelched the other one that was supposed to come out about Citizen Koch, was the title of it. But they control PBS now, too, because you're not going to see that stuff anymore. But it's out there. The information is out there. And I wanted to mention another book. It's called Griftopia by Matt Taibbi. You know, how Wall Street ripped me and everybody else off. Anyway, thank you.
Thanks, Al, for the call. I mean, Al, I think, typifies what a lot of listeners who are concerned about this issue feel, and that's that there's a lot of people getting away with things that the average Jane and Joe don't get away with, and they don't get penalized for it. I've wondered, we've talked about these issues so much, what happened with Wall Street in 2008, the amount of money that's in politics right now, which is incredible, and particularly with billionaires. We just did a show on billionaires. Al's not as upset as he used to be, but it seems to me as though nobody's very upset about all of these issues, and yet they, some would say, really threaten our democracy, and they are issues to be upset about. So where's the anger?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that there is a very there's an angry strain in the electorate that and you put it very well, a large number of people that feel that whether it's the political class in Washington or the elite economic class, the 1%, is entitled to advantages that the rest of us don't get, that the working stiff doesn't have access to. And I think that is a message that we're going to hear from more and more politicians over the years. The question is going to be, what policies are they proposing to deal with that, and how believable are they? You know, I think a problem for Hillary Clinton is that even if she gets up there and sort of pounds a populist message, not a lot of people are going to believe her because she has been associated for so long with the more corporate interests in the Democratic Party and with the bankers and Wall Street. And there's not very much question that she is of the prospective Democratic candidates, she's the one that would be most favored by that class and certainly the one who's most sort of an insider. And so I don't know how that's going to play out in 2016. I think it's going to be a major factor in the electorate. I do think that with the economy getting a little bit better, we hear less pure economic anxiety than we did certainly in 2008, but also in 2010. So much of the voter anger was just, you heard so many voters just saying, I lost my job, my husband lost my job, mm-hmm. we lost our health insurance.
Right.
And a lot of the anxiety that I heard around this election was more generalized. It had to do not just with economic security, because some people's economic situation has gotten better since those really bad days, but with the feeling of insecurity around crime, around the protests happening across the country, and the situation on the border, and around international security, and feeling like the beheadings and the situation abroad and all the different international crises that we've been consulting were leading to a more generalized feeling of insecurity. So I wonder how much of the next presidential election is going to be that pure referendum on economic anxiety, and how much of it is going to be about some of these more international concerns. Mm. I think it remains to be seen.
We will find out. Molly Ball, thank you ever so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Yeah, it was fun. Molly Ball, who covers national politics for The Atlantic, and look her up, Google The Atlantic. You'll find some very interesting analysis she's done of why the Republicans are so strong, what's happened to the Democrats, and the leadership of particularly the Republicans as we will soon begin a new session of Congress. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing The Hour. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks to you. If you didn't get on the air, go to our Facebook page and leave your comments there. We love to read them. This is the Ideas Network.